Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how does President Joe Biden's first 100 days compare historically to other presidents? How likely are his proposals to be adopted? Then, Turkey continues to deny the Armenian genocide. What is at stake with acknowledgement, and how do they construct the denial narrative? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Presidents are often historically judged based on their accomplishments of their first 100 days in office. U.S. President Joe Biden just passed his 100-day mark. On today's show, we will discuss how the current administration's record compares to historical records. Our guest is Jeremy Suri, professor in the Department of History and the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. He holds the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs at UT Austin. He is the author of The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office, and Foreign Policy Breakthroughs, Cases in Successful Diplomacy. Jeremy, thank you very much for joining us.
I always enjoy being on your show.
The pseudo State of the Union address, the address to Congress on Wednesday, kind of marked these 100 days. And you're in Texas, so one of your senators, Ted Cruz, described the speech as boring but radical. How accurate is that in describing the first 100 days of the Biden presidency?
Well, as with most statements by Ted Cruz, it's half wrong and half self-serving. There is a little truth in what he said, which is that Biden is somewhat boring. But that boring nature to Biden is what many, the vast majority of Americans by most polls, find calming. After 4 years of daily chaos, when those of us who are scholars like you and I, Doug, have felt like we're experiencing 5 years worth of change and crises in a particular day, for so many people to have a steady hand, someone who's less about drama, less about yelling, and more about bringing people together and trying to calmly address problems and concerns that we share, that's refreshing. It's almost intoxicatingly refreshing, which is why it's so hard for people like Ted Cruz who want to attack the president to attack him. They look like they're provocateurs. And I think Biden's speech that you referred to so well conveyed that. It was not a John F. Kennedy, you know, we're going to pay any price, bear any burden kind of speech. It was more a Franklin Roosevelt fireside chat. I'm going to talk to you as a father figure, and I'm going to help you as a country come together. And that's why Ted Cruz is just completely wrong when he calls it radical. There are some major big programs that Biden's talking about, some big changes, and many of them are traditional liberalism in an FDR, Lyndon Johnson mode, but they're not radical. Joe Biden is showing that they're American apple pie. And we can disagree on those, but they're not radical programs. They're programs with a long history. And by definition, something that you've done for a long time is not radical. It's part of who you are.
And I know when Biden won the nomination, in particular, when he defeated Bernie Sanders for the nomination, a number of progressives were concerned, downright upset, that this seemed like the defeat of progressivism within the Democratic Party. And here is this old centrist who's going to run. You know, has Biden been a centrist and the center has just moved, or has he actually moved quite a bit closer to Sanders and Sanders supporters?
I think it's the most important question to ask, and you ask it so well. There are two ways of looking at this, and these two perspectives give us a more holistic answer. In terms of the positions and the programs that Joe Biden is advocating for, these are far to the left from the programs he himself advocated when he was vice president or during his 30 years in the Senate. He has moved to the left in his programs. Just take the issue of criminal justice or transgender rights. This is a political figure, Joe Biden, who earlier in his career defended maximum security prisons and was not considered a friend of those with transgender interests and concerns. And now those are at the center of his programs, trying to reduce what he sees, and I think many Americans see, as an unfair criminal justice system that disproportionately imprisons and harms people from certain backgrounds. And as he said in his speech, he wants to stand up and be the person who's there to provide, to guard the backs, as he said, of transgender members of our community. So he's moved on those issues substantively. And in some ways, his substantive programs do look like some of the things Elizabeth Warren and Benjamin and Bernie Sanders have been talking about. On the other hand, he's a centrist in the way he approaches these issues. There's the substance of the program, and then there's the way you implement a program. He's not pursuing programs designed to break up or divide or undermine the ways American society operates. He's not trying to bust up corporations in the way that Elizabeth Warren talks about that. He's not trying to radically change our institutions. What he's trying to do is in pursuing these changes that he believes are necessary for our country, particularly after COVID and after the challenges to our democracy in the last 4 years, he's trying to do this in a way that brings people together. And of course, it's not appealing to leaders of the Republican Party, but he's framing these issues, and the framing is the serious part of the issues. It's not just propaganda. He's trying to make these issues issues that matter and address the concerns that the vast majority of Americans have. And that's what his speech was all about. So why do we care about criminal justice? Well, not simply because certain groups are being mistreated, but because we all benefit from a better criminal justice system. Why do we care about transgender rights? Not because we only want to help those in those communities, but we all benefit from a more tolerant, open society. Why do we want aid to those who are suffering from COVID and COVID conditions? And why do we want their communities to have more help? Well, because that benefits us all. So when you frame things in terms of common benefit and you direct your programs in that way, you're not radical. There might be programs you adopt that were also supported by radicals, but that's what liberalism is all about, trying to bring as many people together with programs that serve the interests of people who are not being served in other circumstances.
What's interesting is, since you're talking about framing, is this really at its core a political issue? And so some of the successes that Biden at least initially seems to have achieved is because he's been able to reframe these issues. I don't know how much of this is substantive policy. I think of, for example, you know, to give you an example, is on climate change, where he almost never says the words Green New Deal. Instead, he keeps talking about it being a jobs program, although the policies he's advocating are really not that dissimilar to what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Ed Markey or, you know, the proponents of the Green New Deal would have wanted. So is really the key difference between the way the progressive wing, what they might want, and what Biden is delivering on, basically a political question about how he's framed the issue, or how much of it is substantive?
I think it's substantive in all ways. The framing is, of course, also political. Everything is politics, right? But it's substantive because you're right that many of the elements of his climate program echo things that were in the Green New Deal. But unlike the Green New Deal, he is also explicitly, in substance, connecting climate change and what we're doing about climate change to jobs for vocational workers in communities that feel they are left out and often are fearful that green policies will take away the few jobs they have left. He did this very well in his speech and very sincerely, saying that we are going to pursue a greener economy, but an economy that provides more jobs for Americans, many of whom do not have a college degree. And he's referring to parts of our country that have turned in the direction of Trump and others, because these are communities often of white citizens who feel they're uneducated and don't have access to the resources that more educated communities have. I don't think that's window dressing. That's the substance of what he's about, connecting doing the right thing for the environment with doing the right thing for ordinary citizens. And that's what politics, the substance of policy, is about. I always tell my students, I'm sure you do too, that policymaking is an art, and it's putting things together that theoretically in our seminars we wouldn't put together, but that have to be put together in substance to bring people in a democracy together to support programs that are necessary.
I know I've been surprised at the agenda, the legislative, the administrative agenda since Biden's inauguration. And I would describe it as certainly further to the left than where I thought he would be. I think you agree. What's motivating that? What's compelling Biden to move more to the left?
You know, as a historian, my answer is what we always say: context. We like to think that leaders make history, but as Abraham Lincoln said, history makes the leaders. It's not that leaders don't matter. Leaders matter enormously, because their job more than anything is to read the moment and understand the moment and apply the often limited tools they have to that moment. And that's where I think Joe Biden's experience matters so much here. Whether you like him or not, this is someone who's been around a long time and thought a lot about what's happened to American society in the last 30 to 40 years. He sees how different this moment is from 20 years ago. And therefore, how the tools we need to use have to be different. He would not be pursuing the policies he's pursuing today if he had been elected president instead of Barack Obama in 2008. But we're in a very different world in 2021 than we were in 2008, 2009.
And certainly one of the areas where he has been most progressive, most to the left, is the notion, and so many people have noted this, that if the era of big government ended under Clinton, the era of big government has returned under Joseph Biden. Is this driven by our experience over the course of the last 14 months because of COVID?
I think in large part it is. It's not entirely driven by that. You could argue that the high point for the argument that government is the problem, not the solution, is of course Ronald Reagan's presidency. And Ronald Reagan's success is forcing Democrats to adopt that position, which, as you pointed out so well, is articulated by Bill Clinton himself. He's a Democrat who echoes Reagan, saying the era of big government is over. And he reduces the budget, and Bill Clinton actually runs a budget surplus. People forget that. But already in the early 2000s, you begin to see real concerns about that as inequality grows in American society. And we see the challenges of holding our democracy together with such gaping inequality. And I think the problems of inequality in our society that have been growing, that have been leading to anger among multiple communities, not just minority communities, of course, those then were multiplied very much over and put into our faces, becoming undeniable with COVID. When you look at how vulnerable communities suffered so much more, how those who had access to jobs, like you and I, who are so fortunate to have jobs where we can work largely from home, and we have access to what we're using now, Zoom and electronic digital communications. Some people in frontline jobs don't have access to that. They get paid less and they're harmed in these moments when they're needed most. And so I think that's significant. I'll tell a little story here from Texas that's relatively, I think, striking. We, of course, it's a problem in addition to COVID. We lost power for a week a few months ago. And it's strange because we produce more energy in Texas than in Saudi Arabia, but yet because we have an antiquated grid, an antiquated delivery system for that energy, because government hasn't invested in it and has left it to private producers to manage their own grid. Imagine having private people manage our highways, right? We couldn't deliver in a mild storm by Midwestern standards. We couldn't deliver energy. Well, just today, a poll came out from the Texas Tribune and the University of Texas, which showed that 80% of Texans now believe that the state government should step in. 80% of Texans should step in and use state resources and state regulatory power to improve the electrical grid. I guarantee you that poll was exactly the opposite 14 months ago. But the combination of the electrical catastrophe with COVID has, I think, even convinced many mainline conservatives in Texas that, you know what, at least in some areas, we need more government. Maybe we still don't want the government coming after our guns, but we must have more government activity to keep us healthy and to keep the lights turned on. And that's a big change from where we were a few years ago. And that is the story of COVID and everything we've experienced the last 14 months.
You listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing President Joseph Biden's first 100 days with Jeremy Suri of the University of Texas, Austin. Obviously, President Biden faces a Congress that is going to be a bit more hostile than what he's seen over the first 100 days when he's achieved most of this via executive actions and at least, you know, one, you know, piece of legislation that, you know, the COVID relief without the threat of a filibuster. In a speech, President Biden had a broad sweeping agenda. How's Congress going to respond to this?
Well, that's the key question, right? I think you're going to see different kinds of responses from different groups. Biden's strategy, and we'll only know if it works in a few years' time when Scholar Circle does its major analysis of this, as only you can. His strategy is to set the agenda, to be the agenda setter, right? That's the phrasing we would use as scholars, right? Instead of leaving this to Congress to come to him with bits and pieces, he's setting the agenda. He's setting a high bar. And he's setting a high bar that he knows is broadly popular. Everything he proposed from investment in infrastructure to investment in families to investment in childcare has more than 50%, more than 60% in most cases support if you poll people across the country. Doesn't mean it has that support among Republicans. And of course, the Senate is divided 50-50. But he's putting out an agenda that is broadly popular, and he's forcing the other side, the Republicans, to react to that. He's also trying to hold Democrats together by saying, look, this is what we're about. Instead of coming to me with your individual programs, let's all work toward this. And he knows he's going to have to negotiate. But he's betting that he can use public pressure and the desire the Republicans have to be seen as something other than a do-nothing party. He kept saying in his speech, do something, that that will force them to come to him with substantive proposals. So I don't think he's going to get a $2 trillion infrastructure program, but he's going to get something pretty large, I think. Maybe it'll be $1 trillion, maybe it'll be $1.25 trillion, who knows? And I think that's part of what he's doing. And then he's going to argue afterwards, look, I didn't get everything I wanted, but I got a lot, and you wouldn't have had that without me. And so I think that's what he's doing. I think Congress will give him some of what he wants. And I think the midterm elections are going to be crucial. He's hoping to build momentum going into the midterm elections to hold the Senate and hold the House. And if he can do that, then in 2023, then he's really set up to accomplish even more.
Now, you said you think Congress is going to give him some of this. Will any of that Congress be Republican voting for any of these bills?
I think he might get a few votes on infrastructure. I think there are a lot of senators from Republican or divided, barely Republican states where the infrastructure is very popular. These are programs that Donald Trump, to some extent, had touted. Remember, he promised an infrastructure bill. And for those in those states who want to be able to deliver jobs to their own citizens, infrastructure is the best way to do it. So West Virginia, I mean, everyone talks about Joe Manchin as the most conservative sort of median turning point Democratic vote, number 50 in the Senate, but also Senator Caputo on the Republican side. She's already talking to the White House. Who knows where that'll go? But West Virginia always benefits from infrastructure. Alaska, Lisa Murkowski, Maine, Susan Collins. So I think he'll get some. Whether he'll get 60 votes, I don't know. But if he can get three or four Republicans and then do this through reconciliation, I think he might have a good deal.
One of the things, since we've talked about infrastructure, that I find particularly fascinating with Biden is the way that he's reframed infrastructure. I had a friend who always said, whenever you hear a politician talk about infrastructure, what they're saying is, I want to fix your potholes. I want to fix the bridge. But when he's talking about issues like high-speed broadband as an element of infrastructure and job training programs, et cetera. But actually, specifically when I think of questions of broadband, COVID clearly exposed a digital divide in this country and one that had fairly profound implications. Is that what's driving this question, is really about sort of the geographic digital divide? And how much is this attempt to reframe infrastructure as a much broader concept than most of us usually think of as infrastructure? Has he successfully reframed that, or is that a political battle that we're expecting to see come forward?
It's a great question. I think over the last 10 to 20 years, people who study these issues, whether they're scholars of sociologists, urban historians, and others, have made the case that infrastructure is something broader than potholes. That where in the past, the economy of a city or a community depended on the quality of the roads, of course, the roads still matter, but now the quality of your internet connections matters enormously. Now the quality of your drinking water, which you can't take for granted anymore, matters enormously, right? None of us are running to move to Flint because of the water there, right? It's just the opposite, right? So I think the concept of infrastructure has broadened, but that had not made its way into the political vernacular until the last year or two. And I think, again, that's where COVID has opened policy space that didn't exist before, because people have come to see to realize just what we just talked about, right? Which is that actually, well, it's not really the pothole that matters so much. It's, can I get on the internet and do my job, or have my 10-year-old actually get some kind of education when they can't get out of the house? Can I get telemedicine? Right. If I'm in a rural community and I'm not going to be able to get to a doctor because of COVID and I need more doctoring, can I use telemedicine? So these luxury goods of the past have become necessities of today. And infrastructure at its basis is, what are the common resources everyone needs to be able to survive in our society? And I think we reached that point with with the internet. And it's also interesting the point Biden has made about education too. It's very hard to survive in our society without some college education now. And that's why the community college point is such an important. We don't have to become a scholar. You know, you don't have to become a useless intellectual like you and I. I mean, you could actually, you know, go to community college and learn how to do something like auto mechanics or whatever. And I think that's an important part of this too, that that's an infrastructure. The United States, and he mentioned this in a speech, it's a very good historical point. We made high school the infrastructure of our society in the 19th century, right? When we made high school public and we made it a necessity, a requirement. And we're moving to a point now where you could say some colleges probably in that same space, that that's the infrastructure of a modern society.
Thus far, we've really kind of been talking about how much Biden could appeal to the middle, maybe the Trump voters, et cetera. But I'm particularly interested as well in how progressive Democrats are going to respond, you know, to Biden. I remember during the campaign that when Sanders dropped out of the race and ends up endorsing Biden, there was an assumption that there were three specific campaign, you know, proposals that Bernie Sanders had made and that Biden was going to have to endorse at least one, if not two of those. And the three were Medicare for all, so universal health care, the Green New Deal, and raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. And I know Biden said he wanted to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, but clearly that, you know, wasn't in the COVID package. It looks like on all three of those, he's not exactly endorsing the progressive position. Does he have a problem on his left where he could see progressives becoming disillusioned because he hasn't gone as far as they would have liked?
I don't think so. I think he hasn't gone as far as many of them like, but he's gone farther than anyone they could imagine in that office right now. And it's very useful for him, actually, if they continue to criticize him and then vote with him. Because the more they criticize him, he shows he's not as radical as the radicals, right? But then he needs their votes. It's the opposite from the game I think Joe Manchin is playing. I think Joe Manchin also wants Biden to succeed. Joe Manchin needs Biden to succeed because if the Democrats lose their bare majority in the Senate, Joe Manchin becomes meaningless. He has power now only because they have a close majority, right? And the same is true for progressives, especially in the House. If he fails, if the president fails and there's a Republican president, you can pass all the progressive legislation you want in the House. It's not going to go anywhere, right? So what is useful for both those in the middle and those on the left is to criticize the president for not being enough in their direction and then grudgingly vote for him or make it look like they're grudgingly voting for him. That makes him look more moderate. And what they're telling their constituents is, look, we're getting a lot for you, not everything. And certainly those on the left very legitimately can say, especially after 100 days, that this president in 100 days has done more for progressive substantive change than any president since LBJ or FDR has done for progressive interests in 100 days. That's not the whole loaf of bread, and they're never going to get the whole loaf of bread, but that's a lot. And why would you not want to support that? Why would you not want to support that?
You know, having you on as a historian, I'm going to ask you a question that's completely unfair for historians. To put these first 100 days into some sort of a historical context about how consequential these first 100 days are going to look, you know, to historians, say, you know, 10, 15, 20 years. So with the important caveats, it is far too soon to be able to make that projection. I'm going to ask you to. How consequential does the first 100 days of the Biden presidency appear to you?
Well, I have to first reiterate your very important and well-founded caveat that we don't know. I mean, the first thing a historian tells you is things matter because of what happens after them. So with that said, I think we will see these 100 days as incredibly consequential for two reasons. They have created change on the ground that will be difficult to reverse no matter what happens. More has been done in 100 days through the relief package, the first relief package, to address child poverty in the United States and to address inequalities than has been done in a long time. And that will be difficult to reverse going forward. And that we will see that turn up in communities that now have more access to resources than they had before. So that's a big change. I think, though, even more significant, it looks like these 100 days have changed the debate. It doesn't mean that Biden will succeed in any or all of the packages he's put forward, but the nature of the debate is different. The Republican Party has been arguing, as you said so well, for 10 to 20 years, that the solution to all things is a market. let the market do this, right? This is the neoliberal argument, and government should get out of the way. Even Republicans are not making that argument now. They can't. It's very hard to see that way forward. And Biden has made the debate a debate about how the government should get involved, with the presumption that it will be getting involved in some way or another. And that's big. The scholarship on the New Deal makes a similar point, right? The difference between Hoover and Roosevelt in the first 100 days, there are some major pieces of legislation, but it's that Roosevelt changes the discussion from why is this the fault of the economy to how can we as a society come together with the government's help to do something about it. That's really what the ethos of the New Deal is. How can we save democracy? And that's the final point. I'll say, I think Biden has restored some faith for a large part of the electorate, not everyone, obviously, that government and that leaders can be helpful and can care. The reason it's hard for Republicans to attack Biden is because people don't hate him, and they actually do kind of trust him. And he's built that trust. And if he can keep that going, that's an enormously powerful thing.
Well, thank you very much. We've been discussing President Biden's first 100 days, what's been accomplished, what are the challenges ahead, and where historically this might rank in terms of how consequential these 100 days have been. Our guest has been Jeremy Suri, professor in the Department of History and LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. He holds the Matt Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs. He's the author of The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office, and Foreign Policy Breakthroughs, Cases in Successful Diplomacy. Jeremy, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on.
When we come back, President Biden's acknowledgement of the Armenian genocide undermines Turkey's denial of the crime. What is at stake for both countries? Stay with us. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. When states deny atrocities, and particularly genocide, they complicate the healing process for its survivors. Why should Turkey acknowledge the Armenian genocide? Some argue it's for the sake of its own country and democracy. Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Over the course of the last 2 weeks, we focused on acknowledgement, commemoration, reparations, restitution, and other forms of ways in which we address genocide and mass atrocity. This week, we turn our attention to denial, when the perpetrators deny that they have committed atrocities and genocide, what this means, and how they construct the denial. Last week, to commemorate the start of the Ottoman genocide against Armenians, U.S. President Joe Biden officially acknowledged the genocide. He is the first U.S. president to do so. Typically cited as the reason why U.S. presidents are reluctant to acknowledge this genocide was the complications it would cause to U.S.-Turkish relations, because Turkey continues to deny the genocide. On today's show, we explore why the nation denies committing genocide and what forms the denial takes. We will also explore the implications on U.S.-Turkish relations. Our guest is Fatma Gocek, a professor of sociology and women's studies at the University of Michigan. Her most recent publication is The Denial of Violence, Ottoman Past, Turkish Present, and the Collective Violence Against Armenians, 1789 to 2009. Professor Gocek, thank you very much for joining us. My first question, when reviewing reactions to the president's acknowledgement of the Ottoman genocide against Armenians, I frequently came across comments like, why is Turkey so upset about the U.S. acknowledgement? It was the Ottoman Empire who committed this genocide, not Turkey. So my question to you is, why is Turkey so upset?
Thank you so much for having me. It's a great pleasure to be here with you to discuss this issue. You are absolutely right. That was actually the reason why I wrote the book. Initially, I said to myself, as a Turkish citizen, I said, this is something that happened in the past, so we can just move on. And then I realized it wasn't that easy. And I mean, I wish it were that easy, but it is very complicated. The main reason is the continuity between the Ottoman Empire and the Turkish Republic in terms of the staffing of the officials and officers. Basically, what happened with the establishment of the Turkish Republic is that many of the former perpetrators became the heroes of the Turkish Republic that was founded. And then they were able to whitewash their past and silence totally the violence, the atrocities they did in the past. For example, we're talking very high-level people, such as the second president and the first prime minister, actually, is İsmet İnönü. He was the head of the special organization, Teşkilat-ı Mahsusa, the paramilitary organizations that actually went and destroyed the Armenians. And then, of course, he became, as I said, the president. There is another president who came after İnönü. First, he was also a member of the secret organization of violence, and he too was involved in persecuting actually Greeks, Greek Rum, who lived along the Aegean Peninsula. So in a way, the main issue is that this is a foundational violence of the Turkish Republic, and if it were to be acknowledged, Turks are afraid, I guess more Turkish officials are afraid that the foundations of the republic will crumble because everything has to be rewritten. And also, in addition, of course, there is nationalism and there is the argument that the Turkish Republic was formed with the blood, sweat and tears of the Turks, not the blood, sweat and tears of the Armenians. And that, of course, will also change stories, and they are worried, I think, that there will be no Turkey to talk about. But I, on the other hand, think that denial is destructive, morally especially. It destroys the moral fabric of a society, as Eviatar Zerubbabel discussed in his book called Elephant in the Room, which is a fascinating book. So I think that is the main reason. There are too many continuities, and many of the business people or the wealthy in Turkey today, unfortunately, base their wealth on the properties, goods, wealth of Armenians, Greeks, and some Jews as well.
So I know certain countries have acknowledged atrocities. We had Elazar Barkan on 2 weeks ago in his wonderful book, Guilt of Nations, wrestles with why certain countries might acknowledge this. I think of Germany's at least restitution, if even though there was no apology to Israel, yeah. The Australian acknowledgement of genocide is a couple of examples of this. What benefits do you see that Turkey could receive if they were to acknowledge? In particular, I know there's a challenge with respect to restitution and, you know, land return, et cetera. But if it was just an acknowledgement without any material, offers of restitution and reparations, what kind of benefit could Turkey get from that?
Well, I make the argument in my book that Turkey will not be a democratic country if it does not acknowledge the genocide, because what happens is that these people, the perpetrators who were then the rulers, let's say, of the republic or the elite of the republic, what did they learn from this lesson? They were able to carry out mass atrocities. They not only got away with it and were not held accountable for it, but they actually were rewarded because they became the elite of this new country. So as a consequence, they do not believe that there is interest of humanity or that there ought to be things that ought to be used in solving, in discussing or diplomacy and such. since they were able to very successfully solve the problem through violence, they then attack every problem that emerges with violence. I mean, a case in point is the Kurds. The Kurds are the major, as you know, the most significant minority, and they are constantly under violence and attack because, I argue, of what had happened before to the Armenians. The same people who were the perpetrators then were also involved in oppressing the Kurds. So there is the continuity, unfortunately. So by acknowledgement, then and hopefully holding people accountable, obviously most of them have died, but nevertheless, just to sort of rhetorically at least, by holding them accountable, there will be this sense that violence is not just easily committed. You are held responsible for it, and then there will be rule of law rather than rule of violence, which is what we have in Turkey today.
You've referenced this sort of the foundational narrative or even foundational myth of the creation of modern Turkey. The group that we in the West, you know, identify with the founders of the state are the so-called Young Turks. How much is that narrative, this modernizing force, how much does that play a role in the modern identity of Turkey, in particular because, as many Turkish scholars have pointed out, one person who has, I don't believe, ever individually been indicted for a connection with the genocide is the actual father of modern Turkey, Mustafa Kemal or Atatürk. Since Atatürk isn't blamed for this, does that give a certain leeway for Turkey to recast the narrative of, you know, the Young Turk Foundation?
It would technically, because Mustafa Kemal was an Ottoman general. I mean, he was a part of the elite cadre of the Young Turks. He was a Young Turk himself. Fortunately for him, what happened is that during World War I, because Enver Pasha, who was one of the other leaders of the Young Turks, because Enver Pasha was jealous of Atatürk and didn't want Atatürk there, he actually sent him away from where the genocide was taking place so that he wasn't involved by chance. And the other thing, though, is that because he was founding a new republic and needed especially top-level soldiers and officers, he allowed people who the British government, the occupying forces in Istanbul at the time, were starting to track down the genocide perpetrator officers and officials. He welcomed all of them into his circle because he needed people with skills, military skills, to win the war. They say that he has always kept them at a distance, but nevertheless, they were also his friends and the cadre that surrounded him. So as a consequence, it's sort of, let's say his record is not 100% clear. He was, one could say, by association, he obviously sort of was there. The other thing is, of course, when he took a stand about the Armenians, he had two different stands. He had a public consumption for the Western countries, and he also had another consumption for the Turkish citizens. With the Turkish citizens, he would say, these are minorities, they have no place here, this is our country, this is the country of the Turks. But then when he was talking to the foreign press, he would always talk about, oh, they are here, we will include them, we will treat them equally, and we have no animosity towards them. And that's what we know, of course. Now we can compare the two. And probably all those factors come together to make it quite difficult.
So Stovil Budrite has an even more descriptive term when she speaks of inside-out memory versus outside-in memory. So it's fair to say that the narratives that Turkey advances explaining what happened starting in 1915 really differ when they're addressing international communities versus communities within Turkey. At the end of the day, how is this narrative constructed to external communities? How is it explained that, you know, something that I mean, historians agree upon was there was mass death in during the period, but that it's somehow not genocide.
My argument is that this is a duplicitous stand that starts with Western European modernity from the late 18th century onwards, where there are these sort of different ways, the traditional and the modern are constantly in conflict with one another. And it is probably that conflict that sort of has led this narrative. Basically, they say, A, Turks are not capable of, I mean, Turks are human like anybody else. I don't think we have any privilege when it comes to moral issues or anyone else. So that's one thing. The other thing is Turks died as well. And what they say is they say, well, more Turks died than Armenians, and the Armenians killed them all. And for that, they look at the number of Turkish soldiers who died, and it is around 2.5 million. As you know, the First World War was extremely bloody and destructive. So they say, oh, well, 1.5 to 2 million Turks died, and Armenians killed them. No, these died at war, at the frontier. They are soldiers who died. Of course, when you're talking about Armenians, you cannot equate the two because the Armenians were civilians. There were some in the labor battalions. They also died, elderly, women, children. I mean, so you cannot compare. But that's what they're doing. They're basically recreating false truths, which don't exist, unfortunately.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the construction and causes of Turkey's denial of the Armenian genocide with Fatma Gocek of the University of Michigan. Professor Gocek, I always like to ask when thinking about these questions of memory, what's at stake internationally? In particular, you know, part of your book emphasizes the fact that the history of the Ottoman Empire with non-Turkish populations is one that, you know, frequently is described by violence. And you reference the Kurds, for example, which we know is an ongoing issue about Kurdish representation or the possibility of an independent Kurdish state. Is that one of the issues that's at stake? I know Armenians as well have spoken quite a bit about land restoration with respect to this. Is that ultimately what's at stake, or is this more kind of a conceptual identity sort of question for Turks?
If you think about it, now we're in the third generation. So technically, the first generation has died, but nevertheless, they have left, of course, their deeds, the title deeds and such. In Turkey, to this day, it's the Ministry of the Interior that has the title deeds, and you cannot research. You have to get permission from the military to get the title deeds and the history, because if they did allowed it, then people could see for themselves which places have been confiscated. Most of the Armenians were part of the Ottoman bourgeoisie that was emerging at that time. As a consequence, in many towns, they had the nicest buildings. They also were known for their stonework and steelwork and such. And that, of course, is ironwork. And that's also beautiful. So most of them either were turned over to the state and they became hospitals, schools, and in a way they were preserved. In one or two cases, museums. Of course, most of the churches were destroyed or they became mosques instead. So I think you could probably track it down and ask. And there have been at least some lawsuits. So that is one possibility. Restitution financially, of course, is another issue. Because what happened was when the Turkish Republic was founded, they initially didn't want to acknowledge that they were the descendants of the Ottoman Empire. But then, of course, the issue of all the palaces and all the wealth that belonged to the Sultan came about. And then Turks acknowledged that legacy and paid reparations, I think, to the Allied forces for the war for quite a while after that, like the Germans did. So, yes, that probably is an issue. For me, I couldn't care less about any of that, because it is material things. I'm much more interested in the moral ethical dimension of it, because it is very sad for me to see how denial is the last stage, literally, of genocide, because Armenians are stuck in history. When I talk to Armenians today, they talk about 1915 as if it happened yesterday. That's because they haven't been able to grieve because it's not acknowledged. Elazar Barkan and I were once talking to at UCLA, and he said to the Armenians, he said, look, you're getting all these countries to accept the genocide, he said, but there's one country whose acceptance will make all the difference. That's Turkey. I mean, the rest of them, it's great, but, you know, they don't have much power, right? I mean, over Turkey, at least. So he said, why don't you just start the negotiations? And Armenians wouldn't hear of it because, I mean, they are not going to negotiate whether the genocide happened or not, because that's the ultimate insult to what has happened. So that is why I think it's going to be very difficult. In Turkey, though, there are many people like me. I mean, they're even more courageous because they live in Turkey. And civil society, basically, and the younger generation, of course, have more access to everything, and they have a better sense of what's going on. Even some friends of mine who are political scientists say that, you know, Turkey acts as if the genocide has happened. It's just trying to control the reverberations of it in a way. And if you go to Turkey and travel in what used to be Armenia, and I've done that for 5 summers to get a sense, when you talk to the people there, they say, informally, they say, yes, we took the Armenians, we killed them in that, well, and then we threw them down the ditch. I mean, you know, it's all there, but of course, none of that makes it to the state level. The other thing they could also do is talk about righteous Turks. There were also many Turks who protected the Armenians or who saved them. So we could highlight them. That may be another way to do that.
Reminds me of just how popular Schindler's List was in Germany to remind the people of precisely that same issue. I was struck by years ago, in conversations with Turkish colleagues of mine, back in the middle part of the first decade, 2004, 2005, when the U.S. was first passing resolutions, through the House and through the Senate on the acknowledgement of the Armenian Genocide, as to the interpretation, particularly in Turkey, about why the U.S. was doing this. I assumed it was in part because Armenian Americans had gained political strength, and they had allies in Congress that had been particularly effective at advancing these issues. But my colleague from Turkey said, oh, we assumed you were just punishing us for not allowing Turkish bases to be used for the invasion of Iraq in 2003. So I guess this is part of this multiplicity of narratives. It's in that in mind that I ask, when President Biden acknowledges the Armenian Genocide, it's a context here, certainly. The so-called neo-Ottoman foreign policy coming out of Turkey, the aggression in places like the Eastern Mediterranean, certainly support for Azerbaijani aggression in Nagorno-Karabakh. How much is that Turkey's interpretation? This is the U.S. Being upset with Turkish foreign policy or perhaps with President Erdogan versus kind of a bigger, broader issue.
In order to, of course, argue that it's baseless, they have to show that the U.S. has real national interests itself, and that's why it's doing it. Fortunately or unfortunately, ever since 9/11, because of course, the proximity of Turkey to the region, the bases there were especially important. And as a consequence, both in 2003 intervention and then, later ones, it made a big difference whether they could fly from Turkey, from the bases there or not. And initially, there was a vote against it because that was when Justice and Development Party had just come to power. And they said, vote in accordance with what you think, with respect to your heart, what your heart tells you to do. The heart told people not to let the Americans use the bases, which was terrible because, as you probably know, then they had to go literally around the Horn of Africa, come. And in the meanwhile, many of the armaments they had became rusty because of the humidity and everything, and that really put them back a lot. Of course, ever since that, we've realized that Erdogan is being very, as you said, neo-Ottoman and such, and he also bought planes, as you probably know, S-400s from Russia as well. So as a consequence, at this point, also Biden wants to get out of Afghanistan and Iraq too. So I don't think they need the bases as much as they did before, or at least the price they pay for having the bases is no longer viable. And that's why I think we got the acknowledgement this time around.
Now, you had highlighted one of the issues that are at stake in Turkey is Turkey's democratization. In a very specific instance of this, you've made references to this. I want to make sure to ask about this. Are scholars who work on this issue, on issues the foundation of the Turkish state, and any sort of criticism of the government, you know, President Erdogan is becoming increasingly authoritarian. And I know of stories of academics facing political sanction, including imprisonments. I guess first, how serious is that as a challenge within Turkey? And how much is this a convenient issue for President Erdogan to simply get rid of, imprison academics that might challenge him politically?
Well, unfortunately, I haven't been able to go back to Turkey since 2015. For 6 years, I'm out because I signed a peace declaration on behalf of the Kurds, asking the Turkish state not to kill them, but to negotiate with them and to acknowledge them. So as a consequence, I can't go back. Most of my friends are in prison, unfortunately. And others are self-censoring and not talking about these things. That's the only way out. And also legally, if you acknowledge the genocide in Turkey, you can be imprisoned up to 1.5 years. If you are a Turkish citizen and you acknowledge it outside of Turkey, it is 3 years. And if you're a Turk like me living outside of Turkey and acknowledging it, it's 4.5 years in prison. They haven't used it, to my knowledge, yet to imprison people, but they always can. And you never know whether they would or not. There is no freedom of expression and thought in Turkey. There never was. And that, I think, is one of the problems. They also see academics, all the universities, as if they were government bureaucrats or officials. They do not get the notion that you can be there and you can think whatever you want. That's not possible. They always say, if you do say something, it's against the unity of the Turkish state, then they try you for treason. And then it doesn't look good, unfortunately.
So my final question, I think it's fair to say it's unlikely that Turkey would acknowledge the Armenian genocide or violence against communities, violence against Greeks, violence against Kurds, et cetera, during this period under the current president, under President Erdogan. But do you have any optimism that over the course of, say, the next, I don't know, 10 to 20 years, we could see some shift in Turkey's willingness to acknowledge genocide, or at least create a real open, vibrant dialogue within Turkey about whether or not it was genocide as opposed to the current repression?
I once used to be very optimistic. I no longer am. The optimism sort of got destroyed in 2007 with the assassination of Hrant Dink, who was an Armenian journalist in Turkey of Armenian origin. And what is important about that is that to this day, they have the person who killed the assassin, but they cannot and they did not catch or actually try those who gave the orders, who came within the military. We know that. And it came also within the bureaucracy, called the deep state in a way. They're still there. And if it's not accounted for, I mean, that's the first thing I would like to see happen. But I'm not very optimistic. The other opening could have been if the Kurds joined politics. Initially, they did join the Turkish political system. They were elected. And they also, because Kurds were usually the intermediaries who actually massacred the Armenians, especially in the southeast, they have apologized, all of them, the civil society organizations. Then they're not, were in parliament. I said, great, maybe things will change. Well, guess what? They're now all in prison. So I don't know what would go. I mean, with them in prison, there is no democracy, and I'm not optimistic. I have no idea where it could come. The only thing going for it is social media, education is increasing, and maybe civil society will eventually say, hey, This doesn't make sense, but we don't have a strong civil society to counter the state. And whenever they try to do, they're always decimated. Newspapers are closed. All the ones, most of them are owned by Erdogan's sycophants. So I'm not, unfortunately, optimistic.
And sadly, I think I share that lack of optimism, though certainly the president's acknowledgement of the Armenian genocide, I've gotten more questions over the course of the last week to 2 weeks from students. What is the Armenian genocide? Can you tell me what he was talking about? And so if it's done nothing else, it's opened up new lines of communication and ways to educate about the history in the region and this horrible, horrible history of genocide against the Armenian people.
Actually, now the U.S. ambassadors will be able to talk about this as genocide. They weren't able to. And even, as you probably know, one of the U.S. ambassadors to Armenia had to leave his position because he called it a genocide, John Evans. And since that, at least, and the U.S. is a superpower, so I think with power comes authority. Maybe, yes, the truth will come out more easily. Who knows?
We can always be optimistic on that. We've been discussing Turkey's denial of the Ottoman genocide against the Armenians, the impact of President Biden's acknowledgement, and the construction of denial narratives. Our guest has been Fatma Gocek, who is the professor of sociology and women's studies at the University of Michigan. Her publications include Social Constructions of Nationalism in the Middle East, The Transformation of Turkey, Redefining State and Society from the Ottoman Empire to the Modern Era, and her latest book, which addresses this issue directly, Denial of Violence, Ottoman Past, Turkish Present, and Collective Violence Against the Armenians, 1789 to 2009. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you to our guest and to you for listening. The Scholars Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.